Hi, this is Ali Gharib, and I am a senior editor with Open Zion, a Mideast blog on the Daily Beast's website. And I'm joined today by my friend Zed. Go ahead and introduce yourself, Zed.
Yeah, I'm Zed Jelani. I'm a blogger and campaigner at the Progressive Change Campaign Committee and just a writer in D.C.
So Zed and I today are going to be discussing the potential for American intervention in Syria, where we often spar about these things on Twitter. Zed, you're a little bit more inclined to intervention than I am. And so we just wanted to go over some of the basics. Of course, today in the news, we saw some of the dangers of not intervening with a bombing of a government building in a Turkish town that borders Syria. Last I checked, about 20 people were dead in that attack. And so, you know, I think that there is a real cost to not intervening, and one of those costs is spillover. But there's also other factors that we have to take into account in intervening. So what in the case of not intervening, Zed, what are some of the main issues that you see developing in the region if the U.S. doesn't get involved in the civil war?
Yeah, and so, you know, Ali, you laid one of them out. And I should say at the start, I don't consider myself an expert on Syria, but, you know, I am a human, someone who's really concerned in human rights, and I do have some expertise in American foreign policy, so that's the sort of perspective I want to bring into it.
And likewise, I should add, too, that I'm not expert in Syria either, nor really much at all, though I do have a master's degree in philosophy and another one in journalism, so I guess you can chalk those up. But for the meantime, you know, for the subject at hand, I'm definitely not an expert on any aspect of it. But yeah, so
now, I can vouch for Ali that he's smarter than 9 out of 10 people who end up talking about it in the media, so.
Yeah, and the feeling's mutual. This is going to be a love fest, Ed.
Yeah, maybe. In terms of, you brought up one of the, I think, the most important things is spillover. So, you know, you had a bombing actually today in a Turkish town that borders Syria. It's not the first time that there's been violent spillover in Turkey. And they actually, you know, they asked, a reporter, I suppose, asked the Turkish leader, Erdogan, last week, or actually this week, what he thought about intervention. He was actually talking up a no-fly zone. I mean, he was saying that it may be time to take those sorts of measures. And, you know, it's very, very rare to see a leader of a major Muslim country, democratic Muslim country, actually one of the most popular leaders in the region, actually talk up foreign intervention in their region. And one of the main reasons is spillover. I mean, other than that, you have just a massive human rights catastrophe in Syria. I mean, you have refugees in Jordan, Turkey, many, many other surrounding countries.
If I can just interrupt you for 1 second, Zed, on the
sure.
Turkey, as you said, has taken in a lot of those refugees, and this clearly worries Erdogan quite a bit. And the quote was, he was asked if he would support a U.S.-led no-fly zone over Syria, and he said, right from the beginning, we would say yes. We want the United States to assume more responsibility and take further steps. So that's quite a thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a remarkable quote to see from someone. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that from any, particularly democratically elected Muslim leader in the region. I mean, I guess during the 1991 Gulf War, you had Arab states, you know, saying that America and the world needs to come and take Iraq out of Kuwait and that sort of thing. But it's very rare to see, like, a popular democratically elected leader actually talking up American intervention in a country. Almost unique. So, you know, that's certainly one factor. But other than the spillover, like I said, it's a human rights catastrophe. And I think the main question, you know, that comes into play for me is RPT, which is responsibility to protect, the sort of international consensus that's developed in the past couple decades about how, you know, some human rights situations become so severe that there is actually a responsibility to protect, and that through multilateral, you know, legal organizations like the United Nations, the world should get together and lay out sort of a path to ameliorate those problems. You know, that doctrine came up a few times in the 90s with respect to Africa, and, you know, now we're talking different places in Africa, and now, you know, Bosnia. Kosovo, and now we're talking about it with respect to Syria. So I think, you know, those are two main
issues.
It's worth mentioning
that the responsibility to protect was something that was adopted by the Obama administration as a justification for joining the NATO intervention in Libya as well. So it's not like this is a doctrine foreign to the Obama administration. And in fact, the sometime Obama advisor, Sam Powers has been, you know, one of the biggest, intellectuals and ideologues for this. I mean, I say ideologue, I don't mean that in a negative way, but she's been one of the main proponents of it, as a matter of U.S. policy and as a sort of, not even a matter, but an overarching principle. So this isn't something foreign to the Obama administration itself either. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just wanted to throw.
Go ahead. We can debate Libya. Certainly I think there's some RPT justification there. On the other hand, you know, there is sort of what we'll probably end up talking later. There's a little bit of realist justification in that, you know, Libya was sending oil prices, you know, in a crazy spiral, and a lot of people in the world wanted to intervene just because they thought it was their own interest as well. And that's often what you see in these interventions, is you see, like, you know, there's some human rights concerns, there's some security concerns, economic concerns, and they sort of all come together. Rarely does any nation, especially a powerful nation like America, act just out of human rights. And, you know, we'll probably get into this a little bit more later, but even the cases you see, like, in the media today, people who are concerned about human rights will also try to make a self-interest argument because they know that's more compelling to policymakers, right? But from my perspective as a progressive, and I think, you know, Ali's also a fairly progressive individual, we both come from similar place politically, ideologically. Those are the two main things, regional spillover and responsibility to protect. And then, you know, we can debate about whether it's in America's self-interest to join an intervention and that sort of thing. But just from where I'm coming from, and I think where most where Ali and I sit on the political spectrum, where most progressives will be coming from, would be those two major factors. And I don't know if you agree, Ali, that sort of sums up the more towards intervention people on the left.
Yeah, I think so. That's right. And I think it is an interesting issue for that reason, is because it has it splits the liberal and left in a lot of way, and you have, you know, sort of the basic thrust of left of center kind of public opinion and punditry on these issues. It's funny to watch it. You know, you have advocates of liberal intervention who are frequently advocates of liberal intervention going along with this, and then you have some people who kind of go either way, like the Thomas Friedmans of the world, you know, who's been known to support an intervention or two, has come out and said that he thinks that there's just sort of the prospects, what it would take to do this. You know, he wrote a really sober column last week about the prospects of what it would take to actually intervene in Syria. And you know, so he's sort of leaning towards the non-intervention camp. And it's also, you know, split a lot of people in the region, largely along kind of sectarian lines. But there's also in what you might consider the pro-Palestinian or the quote-unquote resistance camp, there's been a lot of fissures as well, because, for example, you see Hamas, a Sunni Muslim extremist group that works out of the Palestinian, you know, that's about the Palestine issue, has fallen out of favor with Assad and left Damascus, where its headquarters was. But then Hezbollah, you know, we saw with the speech from Nasrallah the other day, Hezbollah, the Shia organization in Lebanon, that's also a quote-unquote resistance group to Israel and claims to fight often on behalf of the Palestinians, has really gone all in behind Assad. And so there's a lot of weird divisions here. And it's made, you know, it's made some strange bedfellows, like who would have thought that someone like you, Zed, would be siding with a lot of people who I know you and I normally find not that savory, but in this case you think that they're making the right policy choice, if not always for the right reasons, if I gather what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point for us to sort of focus on in this. Like I said before, Ellie and I are very similar place politically, but on this we have some disagreement, and that's also driven, or that's also made more difficult by the fact, like Ellie just brought up the fact that there's people who are completely different politics than him and I who may agree more on the intervention side. You know, I'll give you one example. I have, you know, Syrian friends I talk to who say that they have relatives in Syria who say that, you know, John McCain is a fantastic guy. Like, they love John McCain because John McCain's out there every day saying no-fly zone, armed rebels. And so they're like, John McCain's a huge hero to them. You know, I find John McCain, you know, to be a terrible, you know, terrible, terrible politician. All his politics are awful to me. You know, he probably views every foreign policy problem as a nail, and we have hammers, right? And, you know, I don't agree certainly with his philosophy in that, but, you know, in terms of intervention, it's a similar, I guess it's sort of a cross ideological thing at this point. Because you do have, you know, as you mentioned, Ali, there is sort of a massive sort of split right now between, progressives on this. And, you know, I think we can delve into that further, but I think that's really one of the defining things about this issue, because I can't think of too many foreign policy issues where the left is so split. I mean, this is really one of the big fissures.
And it is one of those weird cases where the left-right spectrum kind of folds back over itself. It's just, you know, it happens sometimes. It's one of those strange cases. But let's move on. Zed, you wanted to talk about, I know this is something that you've been tweeting a lot about Syria, is the Bill Keller's piece some 5 days ago, I guess it was in the print edition on Monday of the New York Times, saying, you know, he reprised the line from his column endorsing the invasion of Iraq in early 2003, and said, I'm surprised to find myself in the hot camp again. And then the thrust of the column was that Syria was not Iraq. Do you want to just kind of run down what he says? Because I know this is sort of one of your own bete noirs about the intervention there, the constant comparisons to Iraq.
Yeah, and, you know, I should say that, you know, just to start the conversation, I would agree with a lot of his conclusion, but not necessarily his argument, but I'll go ahead and just, for everyone who hasn't read it, to lay out his argument. So his argument, you know, he starts basically by laying out the argument of people who say that Syria is Iraq. You know, it's a tyrant who may be using WMDs, he defends a sectarian minority. We have war hawks like John McCain saying we have to go to war. But then, you know, his conclusion is that no, it actually isn't like Iraq. And his main argumentation for that is, not like two or threefold. One is that he thinks there actually is a compelling U.S. interest, with respect to Syria rather than, with respect to Iraq. And part of that is the spillover issue, saying that the violence would spread into the surrounding countries. And, you know, the second part of it is sort of the RPT stuff that I was, you know, talking about earlier, saying, let's see, one quote, I actually have the article pulled up, saying that, you know, would we wait until a desperate Assad, you know, drops sarin on a Damascus suburb? And then, you know, the other half of his argument is in that same sentence, or when Jordan collapses under the weight of Syrian refugees. So he's, you know, he's talking both about RPT and about the spillover issue. And, you know, and his conclusion in that is that it actually is in a compelling American interest to do something about this, in the sense that it would threaten American security. So that's like the sort of the third prong, not sort of what progressives are saying more, but sort of what some people on the right or realists would be saying, a realist argument for doing this. In that if we see spillover, if we see, you know, WMDs being used against civilians, this would become a situation where the violence would spread in a way that harms American interests. And in that sense, you know, if we go to, let's see, his last sentence is that, whatever we decide getting Syria right starts with getting over Iraq. So, you know, he's almost, you know, and that's why I don't like his argument that much, even though I kind of agree with his conclusion, is that, not the conclusion of the article, but the conclusion that Syria is not Iraq, is that it sort of reminds me a little bit of, during the Gulf War, you know, there were people who were saying we have to take military action here to sort of excise the ghost of Vietnam, right? You know, there were a lot of American planners who were obsessed with that idea because they wanted to have more muscular use of troops in the world, and they sort of hated the ghost of Vietnam, and I think Bill Keller is trying to do that with Iraq. So, you know, that's sort of his argument summed up in a nutshell, and, you know, he quotes Vali Nasr saying that, you know, everyone keeps relitigating the Iraq war in the, you know, in the United States and the Obama administration. He quotes Anne Marie Slaughter, who's talking about, you know, how we have to change the political calculation for a political settlement.
Soon-to-be my boss, I might add, Anne-Marie Slaughter, is about to take a position at the head of the New America Foundation.
Oh, okay. I had no idea.
We disagree on this, but I like her a lot and respect her work.
Sure. Yeah, and so, you know, I think, you know, that to me, you know, sums up his argument, and that argument sort of, it's interesting, it laid the foundation for everything that was in, like, the punditry media over the past week. So, you had, Rachel Maddow, who, you know, normally I agree with on most things, was saying that, you know, it feels like 2002. I watched your show, actually, earlier this week. Twice you said it feels like 2002. Chris Hayes, didn't make the argument as, sorry, go ahead.
I know when you were watching MSNBC that night, I had to unfollow you because you tweeted like 50,000 times about Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow. I just couldn't take it anymore.
No, it was really aggravating. And
it really got under your skin. I mean, it like really, really got under your skin.
Well, here's the thing. The arguments being made on both shows I found were sort of, you know, they were intellectually very, I guess they weren't very deep, right? It's sort of like America may be taking part in another war, so it's like Iraq. It wasn't like, you know, there was no substantive sort of understanding of why it's similar. I mean, are there lies being told to us? You know, did we go to the UN and fail, and now Obama's saying no, we must, you know,
here's the thing, Zed, is that, I mean, first of all, look, it's television. But right. but second of all, and this is where I disagree with you on the Iraq comparison, is that, you know, yes, the U.S. is about to enter another war, and that doesn't mean the war is going to be just like Iraq, or that Syria is just like mm-hmm. Iraq, or the situation that we're going to enter is just like Iraq. But I think the most ignored lesson of the Iraq war, right, we learned this thing about being very cautious on weapons of mass destruction. You've seen that with the Syria chemical weapons, sort of, for the mainstream American discourse and in the newspapers and so on. You've seen the lesson about weapons of mass destruction. What you haven't seen is the sort of lesson about what the war plan is and what the U.S. capabilities are and what the length of the engagement is and how long we're going to be there. What are the concrete and reasonable goals that we are trying to accomplish? And how do we get out of the situation? Now, war is not perfect. It's always messy. I mean, you know, Leon Wieseltier at the New Republic had this sort of what I thought was a really dangerously sophistic column the other day, saying that people who talk about exit strategy, it's just demagoguery masquerading as prudence. And would people start a business that, you know, that they know whether they're going to make it or not? It's like, no, they don't know whether they're going to make it, but they take every reasonable precaution and step of planning to try and ensure that they do make it. And if they look at that plan and they think and they realize that it's not going to work, then they'd probably be best off as businessmen or businesswomen to not undertake that business plan. Now, that's even true of the more, you know, what might be analogous in that comparison to a more limited intervention of someone who's just trying to build a startup to sell in 5 years to some conglomerate. You want to make sure that you can build a company that's saleable to this thing. And if you look at all the available information and you say, listen, I can't build this company to sell to a corporation in 5 years, then you shouldn't do it. And, like, you know, this is precisely the lesson we never learned in Iraq. And lo and behold, you know, people like Leon Wieseltier opposed Obama's withdrawal from Iraq. We were there a decade. Sure. We lost 4,000 people, 100,000 plus Iraqis.
You know, the argument that you're making, see, it's a lot more sensible than what I'm actually seeing, though, in the sense that, like, the people who are saying Syria is like Iraq, they're not doing it because I think necessarily they're saying what you're saying in the sense, like, you have to think through a policy before you do it. I think the people who are saying that is, the reason that analogy is being invoked is because it's the most negative war in Americans' recent imagination, right? So.
Right, but Zed, it was plagued exactly by this problem that I'm describing. I didn't see the Maddow and Hayes episodes you're talking about, and I don't want to read too much into them. But I think a lot of times when people say we're getting involved in another Middle East war, that's exactly what they mean, is that we're getting involved with no sort of exit strategy. And, you know, even, you know, not you, Zed, but a lot of the people who talk about interventions this way, you know, it does suffer from the same problem of Iraq. It's the cakewalk syndrome, where they just, you know, disregard all the potential risks. I wrote about, there was this really incredible interview with John McCain on CNN, where one of the CNN anchors brought up the fact that that the Pentagon had said that we would need 70,000 troops on the ground to secure Syria's chemical weapons. And what was John McCain's reaction? Oh, the Pentagon exaggerates. Now, if that's not shades of Iraq, I don't know what is. I mean, it's the same lack of planning, the same overestimation of American capabilities and America's the ability of the American military to effect change on the ground in these places. It's all those same issues about being dismissed as we're trying to push for this war.
Sure. But, I mean, to me, that's more of a symptom of, like, America's mentality in general, right? Americans, in terms of the way that American elites, in terms of the way they use their military, have a high level of confidence in terms of what they can do in the world. They really think they can use their military power to reshape the world. And that's, you know, even though I'm a little more sympathetic to that in Syria, it's apparent everywhere. It's apparent in what they do in East Asia in terms of what they build up in Australia.
Why do you think that you say you're more sympathetic to that argument that they can, that the military can be used to reshape Syria? Why are you so optimistic in the Syria example? I mean, I presume I know that you were young at the time, but I presume you opposed the Iraq war. Why are you so confident in the Syria example that can work, that the American military can be used to shape a society in our favor? I mean, that is what you're talking about, right?
Well, look, you brought up Iraq, and I think that's a good. I should explain, you know, why I opposed the Iraq war, and then I can dig into Syria. I oppose the Iraq war because there was no war, right? Iraq was a completely defanged country that had been under sanctions for, you know, decades and airstrikes, and, like, Saddam Hussein was a tin pot dictator. The WMD evidence was laughable. You know, no senator should have voted for that, given what they were presenting was completely laughable. There was no threat to the U.S., and I knew anyone could tell that if you started a war there, you would cause a tremendous amount of suffering for people there, and if you invaded, you would cause a tremendous amount of suffering for American soldiers. So it just seemed kind of like a pointless war. With Syria, we don't really have a choice. It's not like we are choosing we're choosing our involvement in a war, but there's already a war, right? There's a war that we're over 70, between 70,000 and 100,000 people are dead.
A brutal one, yeah.
Yeah, a terrible war. It's already happening. We're not choosing it, right? We're not causing a war. Which is what I really hate as a progressive. I don't like causing wars. There's enough war in this world. But there's already a war going on. It's spilling over to several different countries. Israel's taking advantage of it. They're bombing Syrians as they're fighting each other, and they're doing it in a self-interested way. They're not trying to liberate Syria. They're not trying to help the rebels.
Israel is very, yeah. I mean, you know, setting aside the legality of their strikes, which I do think this idea, you know, this is sort of the same idea of America, that there's this, you know, westernized hegemony that's free to intervene wherever it likes, irrespective of international law. Setting aside those legal issues, I think that Israel's intervention wasn't unreasonable at all. They're looking out for their core national interests.
I don't agree with their strike. I mean, I think it was wrong for them to do it. But from a military strategic point of view, you're basically talking. Yeah, I mean, it's very straightforward. They're trying to weaken two of their nemesis, Syria and Hezbollah, right? They're thinking that, you know, if they transfer weapons. But no, that's not what progressives are trying to do in Syria. We don't want to, you know, we're not just there to weaken the country of Syria like Israel is. We're not, you know, Hezbollah is, you know,
I don't think it's even about weakening Syria, Zed. I think it's about these munitions being passed to a group that they view as a critical threat on their northern border. I think it really is, but they view
Syria and Hezbollah as the same axis, though. So
yeah, that's true. I mean, and they are in many ways the same axis. That much is evident from the way the war is playing out. But the issue is not, you know, the issue is not these weapons being in Syria and or being used against Syrian people. The issue is them being transferred to Hezbollah, which runs a much higher risk of using them against Israel, because Hezbollah, unlike Syria for the past 40 years, Hezbollah actually does fight wars against Israel. And so, like, you know, I actually think that that's their involvement has been, you know, like I said, setting aside the legal issues, their involvement has been very prudent. And it's funny that a lot of the you know, not you per se, but a lot of the kind of pro-Israel hawks that want us to go into Syria don't look at the Israeli example of why Israel's limited intervention. Instead, they hold it up as this ridiculous thing about how weak Syrian air defenses are, when that's really just a red herring. I mean, that's a straw man if I've ever seen one. And they don't actually look at why Israel intervened, and maybe, you know, since Israel's so great, we should look at why they're doing it and what they're doing and the limited scope of it, and see that they're acting on their core national interest here.
Right, and, you know, that's an area where you and I would agree. I mean, I've seen you make this argument that intervening in Syria isn't necessarily in America's national interest. And, you know, I would, you know, it always depends how you define national interest, but in a very, you know, very bare bones way, like, can America protect its security without intervening in Syria? And I would agree that yes, it can. Any spillover that happens can be contained. What happens within Syria isn't necessarily all that threatening. I mean, it doesn't, you know, we talk about WMDs and all that. I mean, if America really wanted to, it could be like go and bomb the WMDs, you know, it doesn't have to fear them that bad. But, you know, again, I'm coming at it from a progressive point of view. I'm not just looking at, you know, the realist national security interests. And I think this is, you know, you asked me the question earlier. I should get into it now. Why do I think intervention, and I shouldn't say, I'm not like, you know, let's start tomorrow sort of guy. I'm a, like, this is a strong possibility, this is a good idea sort of guy. So,
yeah, I'm with you too. I think we both have sort of soft positions. Like, I'm not just blanket opposed to interventions.
Right.
You know, and I'm open to the arguments, and I think there are reasonable arguments. I think, you know, just sorry to interrupt you, but just briefly, I think that the two best ones are the responsibility to protect, and also the if chemical weapons are indeed proven to have been used in a systematic way as a form of slaughtering Syrian civilians, then I think that there is, you know, I wrote about this, that it's with 70,000 plus dead, it seems a little awkward to say that what the real American interest here is in preserving the international taboo against chemical weapons use. But I have to say that I do think that that is a factor, and it is an important mm-hmm. one. But anyway, sorry to interrupt. You should go back.
No, please go ahead. So you know, what I would say is that, you know, with respect to what the world would do with Syria, I, you know, my preference is one, you know, nothing unilateral, nothing like what Israel did. You know, I oppose any sort of unilateral action, and it would have to be, you know, working with the UN and getting a Security Council resolution through, similar to Libya. And
right,
you've seen that, you know.
Here's the problem with that, Zed, is that the Russians are never going to agree to it. It's just not, the Russians are not going to agree to it. And particularly, what they did, why they won't agree to it, is exactly because of Libya. Because they agreed to Libya, and what did they get? They got this U.S. and NATO mission creep. They got, the U.S. was supposed to go in on an R2P basis and enforce no fly zones and no drive zones. We can talk in a little bit about what that would mean for Syria. And then it ended up making offensive strikes against to cripple the regime. It was more than just creating safe zones. It became an offensive air war. And I don't think that it was the worst idea in the world, but the way it was conducted is certainly what prevents the Russians from getting behind anything on Syria.
No, you're right. You're right about that. But on the other hand, nothing constructive is going to happen with respect to Syria without getting the Russians on board with something, right? So, for example, the Secretary of State has been talking to Russia. He went over to Moscow recently. He was there this past week.
Trying to organize a peace conference.
You can't get any sort of political settlement, or even a political settlement, without Russia's help. I mean, they...
Right, exactly.
Their political settlement
is very,
you know,
different from a no-fly zone, though.
See, that's where we differ a little bit. There's a lot of people who make an argument, probably convincingly, to me anyway, convincingly, that the government of Syria doesn't have a whole lot of incentive to have a political settlement at this point. They feel like they can keep stalemate forever and they can continue to bombard civilians with MiGs, right? If the global community wanted to create a situation where at least civilians were protected to start with, there would be a lot more incentive for Assad to go to a political settlement. You know, I mean, and what's the alternative? I mean, the alternative is that we have, like Syria becomes Lebanon, and then maybe, I don't know, Israel continues to bomb it every 3 months, show 40 people here, 50 people there, Hezbollah gets more involved on one side, Al-Qaeda gets more involved on one side. I mean, it, you know, it's not like you know, as progressives, we both we don't want wars, right? But the war is happening here, and the war is growing greater, right? And it's going to more countries, going to more places. At least if you create a situation where the world could protect civilians, where you didn't have a giant refugee crisis, you would be creating some sort of amelioration in the country that maybe could lead towards a better political settlement. And like I said, that's, you know, there's a lot of maybes in what I just said, right? So that's why I'm not like the let's go tomorrow guy, right? But I am very open to it. And I think one of the reasons I'm so open to it is because I hear this a lot from people in the region. And this is very rare to hear from people in the region that America should come or that, you know, EU should come and do something. Because, you rarely hear that from the Arab Muslim publics. And, you know, I know you brought up the Libya case, and I agree with you that there was a lot of mission creep and that it probably went beyond their legitimate boundaries with respect to what they were doing with RPT versus the regime change. But if you look at Libya, Libya is one of the few countries in the Middle East where America has a positive approval rating, right? Like, Libyans are grateful for what America did. And there were a lot of problems with it. They certainly shouldn't, you know, Obama should never have done it without an approval of Congress. I say that as a strict constitutionalist, progressive constitutionalist. But, you know, there's the point that America has a 52% approval rating in Libya, right? This was something that was agreed in the region. And, you know, there's some people who, like Juan Cole, experts, who've made really good arguments that you can't do the exact same thing as Libya. One reason being that most of Syria's military placements are in crowded urban zones, so you really can't wage a war just against the military to protect civilians. You'd be harming a lot of civilian population, be harming a lot of infrastructure. So, you know, that's a compelling argument to me. That's a good argument. The argument that I hate, and the argument that makes me really angry, is when people say that, one, Syria is Iraq. I laid out the differences between Syria and Iraq. And by the way, the argument that you raise is not as terrible, you know, and that we should actually think things through before we do them. That's common sense argument for any foreign policy adventure. But, and then two, that, you know, we just shouldn't get involved because it's better, you know, it's better for America to not be on the side of, you know, the people in Syria who are rising up. I mean, the argument, okay, I know you say you didn't watch Maddow's show, but Rachel Maddow had on Patrick Murphy. And Patrick Murphy said, this is Al-Qaeda versus Hezbollah. You know, we don't want either one of them to win, so why are we getting involved? And Rachel Maddow just kind of nodded her head and smiled and said, yeah, it's just like 2002. Like, this is a completely ignorant argument. It's an argument being made by people who have no understanding of Syria, have no understanding of, first of all, Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a horrible terrorist group we should be fighting. Hezbollah we should be engaging with to some extent. It's necessary for a political settlement in the region. And besides, both those factors right now are minority groups within the revolution, right? So when the revolution started in 2011, there was no Al-Qaeda there. Hezbollah started to come in, but still played a fairly minor role. Even Iran was distancing itself from Assad. When the revolution started, Assad was using primarily police to attack and brutalize protesters and arrest them. He let some political prisoners go. But, you know, 6 months into the revolution, they started using the military heavily, right? They started bombarding people. They started killing people in huge numbers. And then, you know, people inside Syria started saying, okay, maybe we need to team up with the jihadists. Maybe we need to team up with Saudi and Qatar, who are, you know, giving tremendous amounts of money. You know, the situation, to me, is becoming so severe in terms of within Syria and without, that it almost seems like, it seems kind of silly for us to just say, well, oh, it's in America's interest, we can contain all that, rather than, you know, to play a positive role. And like you, I'm very, very skeptical of any war. I mean, I'm like, you know, near pacifist in many ways, right? Like, if I was in Congress after 9/11, I would have voted with Barbara Lee against, you know, the invasion of Afghanistan. I would have said we need something very surgical, very light and quick, to get the people responsible. We don't need to invade Afghanistan. I would have said that. I was opposed to war in Iraq. You know, I'm very, very close to you in terms of, you know, how anti-war I am. But I just don't think, you know, we're not choosing a war in this situation. The war is happening. And I at least wish we could do something to protect the massive civilian population that's being bombarded with MiGs every single day, that's being pushed into refugee camps into all the surrounding populations. To me, that is an enormous, you know, enormously just awful thing happening. And in Syria, which is a beautiful country, and I've known Syrians, you know, for years since I was in college, a country that I think in many ways, other than its terrible government, was something that we could look forward to in terms of, like, its embrace of multiculturalism, its embrace of pluralism. It wasn't even that sectarian, even though Assad obviously did oppress the Sunni population and others. And it's gonna be like Lebanon, Ali. It's gonna be an extremely fractured country where extremists are rising, for decades. And it's not gonna be, you know, you talk about the resistance axis, right? And I think this is interesting. Maybe we should go into this about the Israel folks. You know, people, sort of on the Palestinian side, right? So like people like you and me who are really into Palestinian solidarity, we have been out there sort of saying that we are against Assad. I mean, there were 100 Palestinian writers who like signed an open letter saying, Assad, don't use our name to oppress your people or something, right? On the other hand, there's people who are just, you know, they're so angry at America for what it does with Israel that they don't want any American involvement. Or they lionize Assad, say he's against Israel or whatever. You know, you can tell that's a lie by the fact they won't even respond to Israel bombing them. To me, you know, not only is there sort of this fact that Syria is imploding, it's the fact that if these countries where the Arab Spring is happening, if they don't succeed, and I know you disagree with me about whether it can succeed or not with an intervention, you know, we'll be in a situation where Arab countries continue to be weak, continue to be fragmented, continue to be sent backwards from democracy, and you won't see any sort of resistance axis. You won't see, you know, powerful independent countries like Turkey, democratic countries like Turkey, taking a bigger role in leadership. You'll continue to see countries on the outside being incredibly able to push, you know, whether they be Russia, United States, Israel, continue to push around these Arab countries because they are weak, divided, sectarian, fighting amongst themselves, dealing with humiliating extremists and dictators. It's really, really important to me that the Arab Spring succeeds and that these countries become prosperous, successful, democratic. I know that's not easy. If you look at Libya, it's not easy. If you look at Egypt, it's not easy. But if Syria turns into a Lebanon situation where they have decades of civil war with rising extremists on both sides, it's certainly not going to happen, right?
The problem is, what do you think the U.S. can do to prevent there from being a Lebanon-style civil war? You know, maybe this is a good chance for us to talk about some of the different modes of intervention. Sure. I mean, look, let's go through it quick, right? The basic options are a no-fly zone, directly arming the rebels, and securing the chemical sites. Now, let's go down that list. And I mean, which ones of those do you favor in particular?
I would say, you know, that with respect to no-fly zone, that would be the most compelling tool used to protect civilians and to reduce the sort of the pain that's happening right now.
How do you want that to be pulled off? I mean, this is what I don't get. Okay, you set up a no-fly zone and Assad can't fly his MiGs. Are you going to also do the no-drive zone as they had in Libya? You remember that there was the French intervention, right, which was the no-fly zone. And then Obama and NATO came in and imposed the no-drive zone, right, on the heels of the Security Council resolution. Because right. Obama's military advisors told him that you're not going to be able to – Gaddafi's forces are coming in, tanks and jeeps, and you're not going to be able to stop them with just a no-fly zone. If you want to stop them, you have to impose this no-drive zone that prevents these ground vehicles from getting to Benghazi as well.
Right.
And so you presumably want this to be the case in Syria as well. But the problem is that there's no Benghazi. It's not a safe zone like that. I mean, there are places that are rebel-controlled territory, but the sort of focal points and the sharpest points of the conflict are places like the Damascus suburbs and places like Aleppo. Aleppo is a divided city. I mean, how are you going to enforce a no-fly zone in Syria's largest city that regime territory and rebel territory is divided by a river? Could it potentially reduce the use of artillery from outside the city bombarding the city? Yes. Will prevent artillery from being fired from the regime side of the city into the rebel side of the city? Probably not. I mean, that's the sort of urban warfare. I don't know. I'm not a military expert, but I would expect not. You know, having seen the examples of the chaos of urban warfare, that to me sounds like it's a pretty unfeasible option, right? And then I just don't know where that gets us. I don't know how that stops all the killing. Remember, Iraq, I mean, I know that there wasn't a war there before we entered, and that's a fair argument. But remember that we went to Iraq. I mean, you know, we had a no-fly zone there forever. We went in, obviously, we controlled the skies when we went in. We also had 170,000 people on the ground there, and Iraqis were still dying at an incredible clip. While we were on the ground there, we were unable to stop sectarian fighting, We're unable to stop the growth of extremism, and I just don't understand what you think about the about intervening in a less in a more limited fashion in Syria, how that would prevent some of those same outcomes.
Well, here's the thing. I think we've talked about this before. You think Assad will fall whether there's intervention or not, right?
Eventually, yeah. But the problem is that when Assad falls, what happens? I mean, this is, and I know you're not John McCain, but this is what drives me crazy about John McCain. John McCain a year and a half ago said that we should launch airstrikes against the regime. Not a no-fly zone, but launch airstrikes against the regime. And so, so I'm just not sure, like, and he acts like when the regime falls, everything's going to be hunky-dory. Well, once again, I mean, I think that the Iraq example is valid. When the regime falls, everything is not going to be hunky-dory.
No, and, yeah, but, I mean, you could say that, you could say Syria turns into Iraq, you could say Syria turns into, you know, Libya, you could say Syria turns into, you know, any number of other countries, right? There are a number of countries where similar analogous things happened, right? But, you know, here's the thing. Nobody's serious, anyway, is arguing that we invade Syria, that we sort of reshuffle its government in a super incompetent way and try to impose, you know, sort of a really, really this sort of ignorant structure onto the country that sets off, you know, even more of a civil war.
No. John McCain, rather than saying we should invade, John McCain says absolutely no boots on the ground, and then talks about securing chemical weapon sites. What, doing it with tomahawks? Blowing up chemical weapons installations that are deliberately placed in civilian areas with tomahawk missiles? Does that sound like a good idea? And then he dismisses this Pentagon number of 70,000 and says it needs to be an Arab League intervention, but doesn't spell out how it's been done. Michael O'Hanlon, the you know, pro-Iraq, the guy who's famous for his pro-Iraq war punditry that sort of lent credence to the democratic acquiescence to going to Iraq, Michael O'Hanlon wrote a column that we should do a Bosnia-style no-fly zone, an intervention that includes, Zed, the 20,000 U.S. troops on the ground. Now, what are you going to do? You're going to put 20,000 troops on the ground when we need 70 to supply to secure the chemical weapons? That sounds like a bunch of sitting ducks to me. I mean, it's just none of it adds up. No one has made a compelling case that can overcome all these arguments together. It just the idea of this no-fly zone or securing weapons, or for that matter, in many ways, arming the rebels, it just doesn't add up.
Well, you know, I just want to say these people are a little bit different than what I'm talking about, right? They want to militarily reshape Syria. They want to attack the government. You know, people who are talking about strict RPT and the spillover is really, really tied into RPT because of the refugee population.
They're talking about
protecting the civilian population of Syria, right? If they enact a no-fly zone, right?
Yes.
They're not talking about waging war against the Assad government and bringing it down. And you said yourself that you think the Assad government will go down. So if you protected civilians and reduced the amount of killing, which would reduce the amount of spillovers, while the rebels continue to wage war against Assad, and eventually he goes down anyway, I mean, where's the big objection then?
You're right, Zed, that I do think it's inevitable that Assad falls. And partly that's just sort of my utopian idealism about dictators. But also, Zed, you got to understand that the question is, will the no-fly zone, is R2P, is an air war of R2P capable of stopping this in the meantime before Assad falls? And how long are we looking at? I mean, these are exactly the sort of things we should be gaming out. And it's not that when you plan these things, everything's going to go according to plan. But we have to at least look at, like, the reasonable expectations and estimations we can make about what's going to happen and how risky it's going to be, what the potential pitfalls are, how long we're going to be involved, to what extent, at what cost. And these are questions that advocates of intervention seem very loath to answer. And I think I know the reason they're loath to answer, because these options all become less and less appealing as you go into the nitty-gritty of the details.
Sure. And, you know, I concede that. I think just as a lot of opponents of the intervention will make the Iraq argument in a sort of a sloppy way, and I'm not saying you're doing it, but other people. There are probably proponents of intervention who do want to downplay costs. I mean, that's common in any policy or political argument. People will downplay the downplay the part of their argument that's weaker and upplay the part right. You know, what I would say in terms of like how long it would take, I mean, it would, you know, it, if it's just, if it's, and maybe I'm being utopian now by saying that if it was just limited to RPT, and I don't know that's, what would happen in reality if it actually went down.
Well, you know, can I just interject for 1 second and say that with the U.S. having said that Assad must step down and Assad can't be part of a political solution, and, you know, whether this is a U.S.-led NATO intervention or whether U.S. joins an Arab League intervention or, you know, because I already said I don't think the Security Council is really a possibility. So in either of those types of intervention, I mean, you know, the Arab League in itself with Qatar and Saudi Arabia, like, when you've got a bunch of governments getting together for an intervention that have already called for Assad to step down and have called for him to not even be part of a political process of transition, mission creep is virtually assured. Virtually assured. But anyway, go ahead. So
If
hypothetically there was a limited to an R2P, no-fly zone, no-drive zone intervention, do you think that its effect on staunching the killing would actually be that great?
Yeah, I think it would be enormous, Lely. I mean, you have largely sort of, I guess, liberated zones of Syria where governments mostly pushed out. They're just being bombarded every single day with MiGs. And one thing is that the U.S. has sanctions on anti-air material to the rebels. So they're literally just sitting there and getting bombed every single day. And, you know, it's kind of ironic. You know, Israel does this to Gaza. They say, well, there's some militants there, so we can bomb the entire area. America did this in Fallujah and other places in Iraq. And, you know, liberals like you and me were like, oh, that's outrageous. You know, that's terrible. They can't do that. But, you know, Syria's doing the same thing to these people, right? And I'm a near pacifist, but I still say that everyone has a right to self-defense. And we're denying them the ability to even have anti-air weapons to defend themselves against the MiG. So if we're not going to do that, and I think you and I would probably have some agreement about the arm of the rebels thing. That can have a lot of dangerous sort of externalities.
Yeah,
and,
like,
you know, maybe. Right. Go ahead.
I mean, yeah, I think arming them with anti-aircraft weapons would be enormously dangerous. I mean, it's the proliferation of those weapons is a major, major cause of concern. That's something we saw in the aftermath of Libya, and so I mean, you know, and that's
yeah like, and. Right, and there were actually some of those weapons that got outside of Libya and ended up in other conflict zones, is what some human rights people say. So, you know, that was a legitimate concern, and I agree with that. So, you know, if we're not going to do that, if we're not going to even allow them to defend themselves by getting weapons, and by the way, we're already arming the rebels, let's be honest. We're giving them non-military aid, but that's just displacing money for them to buy weapons from people who are letting them get weapons, right?
And we're also, the CIA is facilitating, you know, the purchase of vetting and transfer of weapons to by Qatar and Saudi Arabia to rebel groups.
And I agree with you that, you know, John McCain is silly when we say, oh, of course we can arm the right rebels. It's silly. It's, you know, he actually, like, mocked people who say, we can arm the right rebels. Like, no, it doesn't work like that. You know, they're fighting a super, super repressive government that's literally, like, just, like, carpet bombing. Well, not carpet bombing, but, like, striking cities with air power and artillery constantly. Of course they're going to ally with whoever they can. If you give a gun to, you know, like a secular Syrian rebel, they're going to run over to the Al-Qaeda and say, hey, look at the new gun I got. Let's use it to go kill that soldier. You know, like, there's no distinction there. I agree with, you know, critics of intervention. That's a really silly distinction. But, you know, with respect to, if it was just limited to, like, a no-fly zone, maybe, you know, no-drive zone, we can discuss that. But the most important thing from what I've heard from Syrians I've talked to is they're sick of MiGs strafing their cities over and over and over, and they can't defend themselves. And that has an enormous civilian death toll. And I feel like if you could stop that, you would push, you know, us towards closer towards a political settlement. It won't solve the whole thing. No, I know it won't solve the whole thing. There's a lot of other things going on. But you'd be protecting civilians, you'd be reducing the refugee crisis in other countries, which will drive extremism into other countries. And, you know, you would have a very successful example of RPT. Now, I agree with you, it's very politically difficult to do because other countries would just want to, you know, push to just take out Assad. Saudi Arabia certainly pushed for that. It would be difficult to get a UN Security Council resolution, but honestly, I don't think there'll be any resolution, political or military, without Russia's help. So, you know, best of luck to State Department on getting that accomplished. And I agree with you that there's a lot of pragmatic concerns with it, but I do think there is a very strong case for setting up some sort of mechanism to protect civilians, especially from the air war that Assad is raining down on them, and that would advance the timeline for a political settlement. I don't know if that's 1 year or 5 years, I'll be honest, and you're right to call me on that, because that is something you should discuss before you do anything. But I do firmly believe that'll make a difference. Otherwise, we're dealing with a Lebanon-style situation where there will be a civil war for 10 years, the country will be in ruins, you know, big victors will be Al-Qaeda, maybe Iran, and probably Israel, because, you know, one of its big rivals is blown to pieces, right? That's an outcome that I hate, right?
Yeah, but one of the problems, Zed, is that I'm just not sure that you know, even a sort of limitless no-fly zone, like no time commitment and no, you know, saying we're willing to do this for years and years, I agree with you that that will probably slow some of the killing, right? That there's almost no doubt that it will relieve some of the killing. But I'm just not sure that it's going to end it. I mean, there's still going to be violence and death and unjust death and brutal death on a massive scale, even with a limited intervention like that.
Right.
Which raises, you know, I understand what you're saying. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what you're saying is that here's a step that we can take that holds not too many risks for us, and that would have the benefit of not the greatest accomplishment in the Civil War, but at least would stop some of the killing, right? I mean,
that's my main thrust. You know, I personally obviously support Assad fine, I support Arab Spring, but the main legitimate and appropriate and least controversial thing for the international community to do would be to create a situation to protect civilian life, because right now there is no protection of them, and we're not even allowing them to protect themselves, and that, you know, that's just immoral, you know, like, I don't think the U.S. has 100% responsibility to do something about this because we didn't cause it, right? We have 100% responsibility to rein Israel in and get them to stop treating Palestinians like crap, to rein Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and Colombia and whatever, right? We don't have 100% responsibility to this because we didn't cause it. But it is very morally questionable to me to be actively preventing people from defending themselves, which is kind of what, even though, you know, they're getting weapons and other means.
The EU ban on weapons is about to expire, and they're not going to renew it. So the EU will presumably be getting some more advanced weapons to the rebels.
Because like I said, I'm a near pacifist. You know, that's what Chris Hayes says on his show. I'm similar to that, but I believe I can't tell people who are dying not to be able to defend themselves. And you and I both agree there's a lot of problems if you actually actively facilitate the flow of weapons to these people, especially because there are some extremists, although I blatantly disagree with anyone who says that opposition is dominated by extremists. They're a minority, and they're mostly there from a strategic alliance. But, you know, if we're not going to let them get weapons, and, you know, there's a much more compelling case that we should be working with. The whole world should be figuring out something to protect those civilians, right? And that's, you know, the extremists of tomorrow are going to be born within that civilian population that's being bombarded to heck, and where Al-Qaeda looks better and better to them, right? They're going to, you know, some argument Syrians have made to me is that Syrians are going to remember this. You know, they're going to remember in 10 years if they defeat Assad, the entire world just sat there and watched this happen. After, you know, we all cooperate with Assad. I mean, Nancy Pelosi went to go see Assad in 2007. We used to send prisoners to him to be tortured. You know, we never loved Assad, but we kind of cooperated with Assad. Like, the whole world was kind of like that. Like, no one really loved them. I mean, Russia had tons of cooperation. Iran had some cooperation, obviously. But, you know, that argument is not completely compelling to me, but it's one argument that people make, that Syrians will remember, you know. they will remember what the rest of the world did when all this was happening. You know, that's sort of a self-interest argument to make. I agree with you, though. There isn't a whole lot of self-interest argument here. I mean, if America really wanted to eliminate the WMD threat, they could do it with bombs, you know, if they didn't care about Syrian civilians dying, you know, that they could contain the spillover. But, you know, there is a moral compunction fundamentally. But if you want to make a self-interest argument, I do think, you know, that's probably the best one you would make, is that if you want a friendly Syria in the future, you would help them now, right? Just like Libya. Libya really likes America. 52%. I mean, that's the highest approval rating of anywhere in the Middle East of America. I think maybe even higher than Israel, you know, like more people in Libya like Obama than Israel.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you to some extent, but the problem is that I just think that you know, I would like to help Syrians too, but I just think that the complexities and the potential costs and, you know, the likelihood of mission creep, I think those are serious factors that you know, tilt the scale moderately in the other direction as far as I'm concerned. I don't think it's something that can be pulled off with that ease, and I guess, you know, I mean, it's a strong, the moral case is strong. I can't deny that. It's a moral catastrophe what's happening there. Mm. There's no doubt about it.
And I want to reiterate, I don't identify with people like McCain and Graham and, like, you know, people who wanted to try the Boston Bombers on any combatants. You know, with them, it's like, you know, there's something happening in the Middle East. We must militarily reshape it with massive force in our, you know, to make it, you know, the way we want it. That's not, you know, we may have some of the same policy descriptions, but I don't share their worldview, right? I'm very averse to meddling and interference and intervention, right? But the moral case is incredible here. To me, it's incredible. Yeah. And the larger arc of history of the Arab Spring to me can have an incredibly positive impact on these people and can make all these countries in the future strong, independent, democratic, so that we don't have to talk about intervention, so that, you know, next, America wouldn't be able to intervene when it's immoral, right? It wouldn't be able to do further Iraqs because these countries are strong, independent, free. You know, and that's the argument I make to a lot of the anti-intervention left is like, look, you want to help the Palestinian cause? Assad was terrible for the Palestinian cause. He always talked about them. Israel didn't love him. But, you know, Israel's not really, one of the reasons Israel doesn't want to help the rebels is because they kind of are okay with Assad. He's status quo, right?
They're wary of what comes next, and he's kept the border quiet. De facto border, I should say.
Egypt hasn't been great for Palestinians, you know, since the revolution, but they've been better. You know, they've been doing more to facilitate dialogue with Gaza. Marginally, right? But it still exists. And it can be the case with any of these countries. I mean, look at Turkey. I'm not saying Syria's going to turn to Turkey, but look at these strong, independent, free, democratic countries that can be on the world stage, that can talk with the credibility of a democratic country, that can represent their people. These countries are important to resolving future conflicts. You know, if we don't have these crackpot dictatorships and extremists running these countries, if we can actually get something towards, and none of these countries are going to be perfect revolutions, but if we can actually get something towards free, democratic countries in this region that have some credibility and have the support of their people and can mobilize for popular priorities, I really think a lot of the other problems you and I care about can come to a conclusion. I think, you know, stronger sort of Shia democracies, if they ever existed, would help, you know, change the situation in Saudi Arabia, you know, the repression from the Wahhabis, right? I know in Pakistan it would help, you know, and Saudi's financing all sort of extremists in Pakistan. And if we had, you know, strong, you know, if Iran was more democratic and could actually constructively engage, it could help defend the Shia population of Pakistan from extremists, you know, work with the majority of Pakistanis that hate the Wahhabis that the Saudis fund, right? Like, all of these countries could play a much more constructive role if the Arab Spring continues to succeed. And that's, you know, a larger ideological goal I have. I don't think that's enough in itself for intervention. You'd have to have some sort of moral compulsion, RPT, that sort of thing. But that's sort of a larger ideological point I want to make. And I know that you do think that Assad will fall one day. You're not sure what will happen next. No one's sure what will happen next. But I do know this. I think they deserve a chance to see what will happen next. After what they lived through, they deserve a chance to see what will happen next. And there are different ways that we can help assist them, you know, facilitate politically. And I think, you know, one of the arguments I would make is that if this continues to drag on, groups like Al-Qaeda will become an enormous presence in this. Right now they're a minority presence that's sort of like, they're good fighters, so we'll bring them in. But they will become an enormous presence, I think, after 10 years, right? And then it'll become, you know, it'll go from Paris to the Middle East to, like, you know, a dump that, you know, Israel can laugh at and say, how, we're the only democracy again, right?
I don't know. I'm not convinced that there weren't currents of, if not quite Al-Qaeda, that there aren't currents of, like, that there weren't currents of extremism in many places of Syria. And I'm not convinced that intervening with a no-fly zone or a no-drive zone or even more robustly will prevent that. And again, you know, we can come back full circle, and I'll point at the Iraq example that, you know, 170,000 troops on the ground, and we brought the jihadists to Iraq. I mean, this counterfactual of now the extremists have taken over precisely because we didn't intervene, it requires willfully ignoring the history of the fact that we have intervened, and jihadists ran rampant in those situations, and we intervened even more robustly, and jihadists ran rampant. We intervene less robustly and jihadists ran rampant. I mean, I'm just, you know.
Yeah, but the circumstances of why they ran rampant was very different. I mean, in Iraq, one, you had a massive Western army attack a Muslim nation, which inspired a lot of people to go to, you know, do what they consider jihad there. Two, they created a security vacuum and completely incompetently destroyed the government, so you didn't have police.
What kind of security is the U.S. going to be able to impose from the air in post-Assad Syria? I mean, this is what I'm talking about. This is a
That's why you don't want the institution of the governments to be destroyed. The institution of the government will be destroyed.
Maybe even with Assad gone, maybe a generation. I mean, anyway, I think we're out of time. So
sure.
Me having warned of a generation of chaos, and you having warned of upholding moral imperatives is probably
a generation of chaos. You get a generation of chaos, and if you win too, so
yeah,
maybe either way, but hopefully not.
So anyway, maybe that's as good a point as any to leave it off. It's a pleasure, as always, Ed. You know, we do agree on a lot, so it's always fun to disagree with you on things. And to talk about it.
Sure.
Okay, man. Well, thanks everyone for listening. And I am Ali Grieb, again, the senior editor of OpenZion.com, which is a Mideast website on the Daily Beast. I've been writing a little bit about Syria, not that much, but just some short commentaries. And Zed, do you want to just give your credentials there again?
Yeah, I'm Zed Jelani. I'm a blogger at Progressive Change, campaign committee, and organizer, and soon-to-be grad student at Syracuse University, so there's that too.
There you go, and congrats again on that. And also, you should follow Zed on Twitter, where he is prolific and full of opinions.
Thanks. And, you should follow Ellie, same Adam. He was an expert at Twitter long before me.
Oh. All right, Zed, take it easy, and thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.